411. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that intersect, confront, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, producer of 411 Teen. How do we equip our teens with the knowledge needed to face the adult situations they encounter every day? Dr. Wes Crenshaw, author of Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens, offers valuable insight for parents of teens, helping them to successfully navigate a confusing and difficult world. Joining me via phone, I welcome Dr. Wes Crenshaw, a licensed psychologist specializing in working with adolescents and their families. He and his team of 8 exemplary teens shed some grounded and thoughtful insights for those hairy situations teens so often find themselves in. Dr. Wes has written a complimentary set of books, Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Teens, and Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. Dr. Wes Crenshaw, welcome to 411 Teen.
Well, it is so nice to be here, particularly because your show has so much the same format of really getting down in the trenches and not only talking to the parents, but talking to the teens and giving some voice to their thoughts today. So I'm really excited to join you today.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. What is it about raising children that we may be overlooking or neglecting?
Well, I think a lot of times for parents, we're so caught up in what kids are doing and what struggles we're having with them that we forget about ourselves and forget to include ourselves in the equation. One of the things I always tell parents that the golden rule of parenting is to not take anything personally, especially in the adolescent years when kids are, by their design, challenging, and their purpose is to make themselves different than their parents. And that's very easy to take to heart. And so I think what folks overlook sometimes is that parenting is really not about you. It's really about the kids, and we have to keep a perspective on that.
That's an excellent point. How do you get them to do that? You know, they say it's easy to say it, but, you know, proof is in the pudding. How do we get them there?
Now you know how I spent my whole morning. So there's a certain amount of coaching in that, because people will naturally take their child's behavior as if it is a reflection of themselves. And, you know, you're a therapist. You know how we have the thing we call cognitive restructuring. You're trying to get people to think differently. And you try to help parents understand that they're not really puppets of their emotions or circumstances. They're in the driver's seat. They have free will. And so they can tell themselves, I'm just not going to emotionally react to that. And as they begin to develop those skills, they can override them with their thinking. But sure, it's lots of fun for you and I to talk about it on the radio. Then going home and practicing it takes a whole other level of commitment.
Right. That's why I ask for those parents who may hear you and go, it's just not that easy. So they need a lot of coaching and a lot of practice in doing that.
Well, and I don't tell people to do things I wouldn't do myself. Mm-hmm. And I've got 2 kids, one who's 15, and I have a wonderful goddaughter who's 20 that I've worked with over the years very closely. So I do come from some experience of having to put myself aside also, and it's lots easier to tell people than to do it, but it is doable.
Yeah. You often say that everything you need to know about parenting can be summed up in one word. What is that one word?
It's influence. Parents need to realize that the research is very clear that peer influence and all of the ups and downs of the social world of adolescence will not, in the long run, predict what a child's adult life will be like as much as will the parent influence. So parents are very influential, and that influence goes either for good or bad. And as long as you see yourself as an important part of your teen's life, then you won't do what too many parents do, and that is sort of throw their hands up and say, well, I got them to 12, and and now I hope they're on their own. You really have to be an influential parent. And there's a whole lot of little, you know, sub-points to that. But that's the one word is influence. Know you have influence.
You want to share just a few of those subplots to that? Because I think it would be really beneficial.
Sure. A lot of how I think about this, you know, I came up in family psychology studying systems and how they influence each other, and I found a lot of really useful tools for that in industrial and organizational psychology. And in that area where they work with businesses, there is what are referred to as different forms of power. And so you have a boss who has legitimate power because he's the boss, or you have the tech guy, you know, that we always have to deal with, who has expert power, so he has influence over whether your computer works or not. And you have the guy who pays you, and he has coercive or reward power. He can dock your pay or he can pay you. Well, there's another kind of power that's known in that field as the most important, and I think it applies very well to parenting, and that's referent power. This is where they talk about leadership in business, and I would talk the same way about it in the home, that the person who has referent power is the person that people want to be like. It's not just they want to like them, they want to be like them. And so if a parent has referent power, that's the parent whose child wants to emulate them. Now, you may think, you know, probably 16-year-olds aren't going to jump up off the couch and say, "Hey, Dad, can I be just like you?" They do that when they're 7, and it's very lovely when they do. But at 16, they tend not to tell you that. But the truth is that the more a parent relies on referent power and the less they rely on, say, coercive power or on legitimate power, because I said so, the more likely they're going to be the influential parent, and their child will, in the long run, want to emulate them, follow in their footsteps, have the values they have, and go along with more of the things they believe in.
How do you get them to that point? I mean, how does a parent, because most parents are going to deal with, you know, that coercive, you know, that power. I said so, do it because I said so, as opposed to getting to that referent power.
It's good to start with parents when their kids are younger. I have the luxury of having been at this for 19 years, and I've logged about 22,000 hours of client contact in that time. So I've literally grown up with a lot of families and young people that I've worked with, and so I get to see and model and mold over the course of time kind of how they interact. And it's much easier when you start out with a young parent and really show them how to do this with a young child, and it's much easier for the young child to become, you know, more interested in their parent and then keep that as a teenager than to suddenly wake up on the 13th birthday and the parent runs in and said, "Hi, I'm ready to be influential." you want to get started young. We always tell people, don't read our books when your kid's 13. You need to start when they're about, you know, 7 or 8. So starting early, then you also just have to get people to think about discipline differently. The word discipline isn't just a verb, it's a noun. And to have a discipline means to have a set of ideas and things you believe are important about the world and how you want to raise your kids within that discipline. And if you really sit and think about that, and far too few people do, then know what it is you want to convey to your kids. And then you're clearer and on message. I can just give you one. I can give you 1,000 examples, but I'll give you one. People who run into drug and alcohol problems with their kids, and maybe they have some money, and they ship them off to drug and alcohol treatment, and it's $90,000. And they come home, and they spend $0 on taking care of their own substance abuse issues. They won't create a sober environment. So you've got to really know not only what you're teaching verbally, but what you're teaching in your behavior, and make that part of your discipline, part of what you really want to use in your parenting. And that will become something your child wants to follow, because remember, the word disciple, it means follower, and discipline and disciple come from the same root word. Good thing to remember.
Okay. So often we hear about parents being friends. What's your position on that? Do parents need to be friends, or do they need to be parents?
You run into this a lot, particularly with parents who were younger when they had kids. And so they more closely identify with that generation if they had a kid when they were 17 or 21 or 22. And, you know, I think all parents should be friendly with their kids, because there are very few people who get disciples by being mean and annoying. You're going to get more bees with honey than you're going to get with vinegar, or whatever
that's
that old saying is. So you want to be, you know, benevolent is the term I prefer to use. The kids need to see you as having their best interests at heart. But that's not the same thing as being a friend or a buddy. Mm-hmm. And so parents have to do parent things, and kids have to do kid things, and those are going to be different. There's no doubt about it.
As a practicing psychologist, would you share your recurrent psychological issues that you encounter regularly when it comes to parenting and teens?
I thought you were going to ask me for my own recurrent psychological issues.
No.
I was going to say, I'm sure I could find a couple, but if not, I'll call my kids and they'll tell us.
No, but, you know, there are themes, and you tend to see, you know, the same thing repeated. You know, it may be manifested a little differently. So I thought if you would share some of those, that would be real helpful.
For girls particularly, and girls are a big percentage in my caseload, probably 80%, the purpose of adolescence is to organize your sexuality. That's really a big part of what you're doing. You're finding yourself as a person, a sexual person, and that's a big part of adolescence. And that's probably a big reason why both of our books, 33% of the books are about love and sex.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most recurrent theme. And I don't just mean the act of sex, but the spiritual sense of sex and the love sense of sex. And kids are really interested in that. And in our society, that has increasingly become, I think, too much about the act of sex. And the kids are certainly quite familiar with that these days. And not enough about its spiritual essence. And I don't mean religiously, but just the emotional part. And so we talk about that regardless of what a kid comes in for. I find that a big part of therapy is to learn how to love and be loved. And kids are really attuned to that. They understand that. So if you come in and you're having problems with attention deficit disorder, invariably that problem is going to impact how you learn to love and be loved. If you're anxious, it's going to be the same thing. If you're having problems with parents, it's going to be the same thing. And so that's really the most recurrent theme, and it's one of the reasons we spend so much time on the books on that.
Well, I commend you on your book. I really like the format and how it's set up, and your involvement, how you have your teens actually involved in the book and responding to the issues. So I want to commend you on that.
Well, we really, from the day one, the book comes from a column, which ultimately was named Double Take. And you know what's really funny, Liz? One of the names for the column we considered in 2004 when we started it was Teen 411.
Oh, really?
I kid you not. So we finally settled on Double Take. But that column has been a weekly publication both in the newspaper here in the university town of Lawrence, Kansas, and in online around the world. And ever since October of 2004, and so we've pumped out 50 columns a year, every year, and every one of those columns is co-authored by me and the, at that time, current teen author. They serve for a year, 16 to 18-year-olds, and they've always had very much an equal voice in what we discuss, and I have to admit that some of their wisdom probably is every bit as good or better than mine. So I'm very proud of their work.
Okay. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I've been talking with Dr. Wes Crenshaw, author, parent psychologist. Dr. West shares expert advice in family relations and communication required for establishing and maintaining positive relationships with your children. Dr. West, your book, I mean, I don't even know where to start with it. You have so much information that is so valuable. You talk about trust, respect, and manipulation. These are three words that you say should be banished from the Black vocabulary. Why?
Yes. This is always a fun one. I just was debating this with someone on a blog this morning, this very issue. I think that language was once magic in our world. Down in your part of the state, you have Epcot, and they have that wonderful spaceship Earth that shows communication throughout history and how magical it is to be able to communicate with each other. So I think we have to think about what it is we're saying, and those words tend to not be too helpful. I hearken back to the HBO TV show The Sopranos, and you'll remember Tony the gangster in there. If you disrespected Tony, he just killed you. He didn't really put up with very much.
Right.
And too many parents have much the same attitude. Not that they're going to kill the kid, but you see them almost that upset because the word respect is so emotion-laden. And we're not even sure what it means. And so I always tell parents, rather than demand your child respect you or complain that they don't, act respectably. Mm-hmm. And we get to that referent power where the kid will want to emulate you. And I had one of the greatest dads ever. I'm so thankful for that. And it never occurred to me to respect my dad until I was about 24, 25. And what happened? My brain finished developing. And suddenly you have what all parents who have young adult children will tell you about is one day there's this phone call, and the kid calls you and says, "Oh, Mom, I just realized how smart you are." That's when people have the brain capacity and the ability to really be respectful. And anything you get before that, you know, cherish, because that's just not how kids are wired. They're not interested in that. So I like to see parents do, as part of their discipline, the idea of being respectable and let kids follow that. Trust is the one that seems to really bother people. I've been doing this for, as I said, 19 years, and I've privately interviewed thousands of kids, and none of them, well, all but one of them, have told me, "No, I'm not trustworthy at all." And that one that said she was, after she came back from college, she admitted she was lying. So kids are built to be different than their parents. They're built to challenge. They're built to, I always tell parents that they don't give freedom. Kids take it. And that doesn't make for a trustworthy individual. Now, what you can hope for if you raise kids right and work with them and become influential and involved with them is your kids, while they're out being where they're not supposed to be, doing what they're not supposed to do, they'll have better judgment than their peers. And that's what you're shooting for. And the better their judgment, the safer they'll be in the stupid situations that they put themselves in. But they're not trustworthy. And I go back to Reagan. It's one of the few things I go back to Reagan about. But he always said, trust and verify with working with the Soviet Union. And that's what I think you ought to do with kids. And then the manipulation word, people who manipulate are usually just people who can't get their needs met. And so a parent should first, you know, look at themselves and see, is my manipulative kid, are there unmet needs here that I need to address emotionally or physically or whatever? Mm-hmm. And if they find that despite their best efforts, the kid is still just jerking them around, generally that's the sign of some more serious pathology. And one wants to really have a therapist explore that. But in general, kids do kid things, and we really shouldn't call them names like manipulative.
So often we hear that it takes a village to raise a child. Is that fact or fiction?
Amen. I think, especially in our current world, I'm a little worried that that not only do we not have a village and that we're moving more in that direction now, but that sometimes we don't even have one or two functional parents, and that becomes
true.
Quite difficult. We have a lot of kids raising themselves right now. I again met with one this morning, and I think she did a remarkable job, But that isn't the optimal way to do things. And so in many ways, as long as people have decent boundaries, the more the merrier. It's helpful to have a grandparent. My kids have a great relationship with their grandparents and benefit from that. It's great to have kids involved in team sports or involved in school where they have teachers as mentors. And in our complicated world, without that kind of social networking, and even some of it can be online, as we well know, without that kind of social networking, I think kids don't benefit as much. They need that stimulation and that love and attention from the community.
In this competitive, technologically advanced world, do you feel like our kids are growing too fast? They're exposed to too much and they don't have a real good handle on how to handle some of this exposure? And I'm thinking about sex and, you know, just the disrespect for life, as far as, you know, the value of life itself does not seem to be very important these days. You know, their option is to shoot and kill, as unfortunately we well know, given what's happened in Cleveland, outside of Cleveland.
Yeah, I just wrote some articles on that today, and that's a struggle in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I think you're really scratching the surface of some of my most recent thinking, and I think you're onto something here. But I think it is an odd bulge. I'm going to call it a bulge in development for kids. Kids are getting to adolescence earlier, and by that I don't necessarily mean physically, though we see that happening. But they're getting to the options and experiences of adolescence much quicker than they used to, and I would argue probably too quickly. And they're staying there forever. A lot of young women I work with in their early 20s have recently said to me, you know, Wes, you told me when I got here that there would be all these, like, competent boys who had grown up waiting for me, and then they would be valuing me for the great girl I am, and that ain't happening, buddy. And I'm beginning to believe kids are staying teenagers much longer than we used to think. We used to think they were up to about 21. They were still kind of adolescents. Looks to me like that's getting up to the mid-20s now.
Yeah.
So kids enter adolescence young and stay there till we're all pretty darn sick of them. So I think you're on to something, both ends of the spectrum. And certainly sexuality is much more a part of teenagers' daily life and experience than it ever has been before, exposure to sexuality.
When you consider parenting, and we're coming from all different perspectives, different backgrounds, what role does culture play when it comes to parenting?
Well, I think a tremendous amount. I think, you know, and while this isn't my greatest area of expertise, I'm always interested when I go out on Father's Day in the city in Chicago or if I go out on Father's Day in the South. And it's a very different experience of African-American culture, of Caucasian culture. They're just different ways families exist in those environments. I always find if I could do one thing every year, it would be go to a different city or town for Father's Day, just because I find it so interesting to see the different ways culture exists for men in our society. So I think that's an interesting factor. And I think culture, and by that same token, culture is becoming much more regional now than it is even ethnic. And I just think we get into different rural and urban environments and different states and different geographies, and we find families are forming differently. And I've worked in a number of different jurisdictions, and I've always been quite fascinated by that.
And also going hand in hand with that culture is the role of the socioeconomic status. Have you made any observations in looking at socioeconomic status and parenting?
Well, I have my bachelor's degrees are actually not in psychology. It's in sociology, political science, and history. And so that's always very interesting to me, and a lot of how I see the world as a psychologist is greatly influenced by how I see it from a sociological standpoint. And so I do think that we have a lot of cultural changes and a lot of things in our society that are making the economic situation even more important to teens. And, you know, we all know you don't have to be one party affiliation or another to know right. that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Mm-hmm.
And this affects families particularly because a lot of young people have grown up in an era that was purchased on the credit card. And so they believed they were quite wealthy. And now that that's all gone, they find themselves painfully at a lower socioeconomic status. And at the same time, folks who are just getting by are being pushed down into a much more dangerous spot financially for their kids, where their kids are not able to get that part-time job that might keep them out of trouble and therefore getting into trouble. So it really rolls downhill mm-hmm. for us financially in this society and poses some substantial problems that I do not hear being discussed this year in the political mm-hmm. climate.
Although I know you said your practice consists of the majority of females, but most folks, parents, are particularly pulling their hair out when it comes to boys. Why are boys perceived as being so challenging and so difficult?
Maybe that's why a large percentage of my caseload are girls. I think boys offer a different challenge. Mm-hmm. I will say a lot of therapists, in fairness, a lot of therapists much prefer to work with boys than girls.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on what you're good at. But I think boys are in a different spot in adolescence. And they're, I almost think they're, I hesitate to say this because it's fairly new thinking on my part, but I think they're feeling more and more marginalized in our society. You know, girls are the dominant culture in college at this point. Girls are the applicants to graduate school. If you're a guy right now, that's pretty neat because you're now in a minority applicant pool. And I think guys are not have not adapted to that very well. They aren't talkative like girls are. They aren't the ones who are necessarily going to go out and talk about these sort of phenomenon. And that's probably not working as well in a society that now values communication of every form so highly with our electronic devices. I actually have a Twitter feed, and I have a list of teenagers that I follow from around the world that I think have interesting, often profane, but very interesting things to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having the hardest time finding boys to put on that list because and I'm looking hard. Mm-hmm. Anybody has any good recommendations, send them my way. But it's harder to find boys because their way of communicating doesn't necessarily work as well for talking about those kind of issues of relationships and love and life and so on.
Well, I know well what you are referring to because sometimes on this program we will have a panel of teens who just can volunteer and participate. And it's much more difficult for me to find males to participate and talk about various issues than it is to find females who are just eager to come and say, oh, yeah, we want to be on. And I always say, I want to have a balance. You know, I want to hear from the males and the females. So I do.
Yeah.
I know what you're referring to.
Well, and we were very fortunate in the Double Take mm-hmm. column to have had two of the eight authors that were guys, and I know a guy that's applying in April that I think will be excellent. So we may have another one. Who knows? I can't control the contest that they
yeah.
take every year to win. But I worry about that, too. I think we need to have some articulate young men talking about some of these issues. It's interesting we've moved in this society, you know, away from that, and we need to reclaim it.
How do we provide young folks today with the skills that they need to thrive in today's world and yet still allow them to have autonomy within their world? Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. And this, to me, the way I say it, I have another pithy little thing I say about
mm-hmm.
that, and that is that the core dilemma for parents is how much to push and how much to hold your child. And so the pushing is the, you know, the enacting your discipline and the setting the limits and the making their life, you know, the way you want it to be. And the holding is backing off and, you know, giving them a hug and saying, I know you can do this. And every parent is going to struggle with that dilemma. And you have to put both in balance. We get too many parents who are trying to be the friend, as you talked about, mm-hmm. or not really. They want to let there be more autonomy. And they kind of have that laissez-faire mm-hmm. attitude. And that doesn't work very well. And then we have the authoritarians, as Foster Klein says, the helicopter parents. Mm-hmm. And they stifle individual thinking. And the research tells us, really, fairly recent research, that the kids who stand up to their parents, who cause the most ruckus and argue and roll their eyes and so on, are the ones who will do better in life because they stand up to people later on. So we really want to encourage that, but we also have to be able to set limits and say, you know, guess
exactly.
what? Because I understand things differently than you do and have more experience, I'm going to go ahead and veto this idea of going to Panama City for spring break mm-hmm. when you're 17 or whatever it mm-hmm. may be.
You know, Dr. West, the composition of the family is changing. I mean, we hear about it all the time. No longer is it mom, dad, and kids. It may be mom and mom or dad and dad, a blended family. This provides a plethora of challenges. How does it impact parenting today?
Well, I can tell you how thankful I am to have been married for 27 years and for quite a few years before we had kids, because we work in a fairly effective partnership, mm-hmm. and I work with a lot of single parents, and I understand how difficult, anxiety-producing, and overwhelming it is just to cover the labor necessary mm-hmm. to parent kids today. And so even divorced families where there's shared residency, often if that works well, if we have a couple of parents who are able to manage that, they do better because they can divide the labor. So at the top of the challenge nowadays is there's so much we need to do with kids and to be a part of their lives and to be the influential parent, that being a single parent is just so time-consuming, it's very difficult to do that. And likewise, I think, or on maybe the flip side of that, you know, any two-parent home can be more functional, whether it's a gay or straight home or a mm-hmm. step-parent home or an intact family. It tends to be better as long as you can have the parents working in harmony, which is why there are so many books about step-parenting, because that's sometimes mm-hmm. harder to do in a step-parent situation.
What about the father absent home? How important is the father? I mean, I think, you know, the idea of not needing a father has certainly been promoted by celebs and those in public eye who feel like, you know, the father isn't necessary. But I would like to have you address that. How important is the father?
Well, I think anybody who would question the importance of a father in a family has not seen very good role models. I think the fathers in the functioning families I know, and when I go out on Father's Day and get to see those families and their kids, I see those as much stronger families, and the research absolutely supports that. Kids get a different experience from a father than they mm-hmm. do from a mother, and that's important. It may not just be along traditional gender lines. It may not just be that the mother is the nurturer and the father's the guy who throws a football. It could be the other way around, but it's invariably because of how couples marry, a different experience, and kids benefit from that. And the father having, you know, I think if you want to know the secret of being an effective male therapist with a large caseload of young women, you're going to learn it right there, because very few of them had strong fathers. And so that's meaningful to them to have an older male who talks with them and shows an interest in them and gives them advice about their lives. It's a very powerful, and talk about a referent power.
Excuse me to interrupt you for 1 second. We need to take a brief break, but I'll get right back at you.
Thank you.
you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holifield, and I'm talking with Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Dr. Wes, I had to interrupt you. Would you like to continue? We were talking about the role of fathers and the need for them, and the need for both fathers, for both males and females. I wanted to ask you to address that, please.
Just seems like when we get to talking about these great issues, we forget to stop, don't we?
That's okay.
As I was saying, that the fact that a father is valuable, particularly for young women and for boys too, comes from my own experience as a therapist, finding out that really that's a very influential role to be in, to be that trusted male in a young person's life, because so many of them haven't had that experience. And while that's tragic, it certainly works well to be able to make a good, healthy, therapeutic relationship with a young person, too.
Warning signals. Would you share for my listening audience, for my parents, at what point they may need to seek professional intervention with their teens?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we actually go into quite a few of those topics about not only recognizing when it's time to go to therapy, but also how to find a therapist in our books. I think that the world has changed a lot in the 19 years I've been a psychologist, from that being sort of the thing you did in the final reel, it was the intervention of last resort,
right,
to being something that's really easier to do now. Kids refer their friends to me to the point where it becomes a problem, frankly. And, I know too many of them, but they're very comfortable saying, I see Dr. West. And parents are much the same way. So I think people are prone to get earlier intervention, and needless to say, that's a real good thing. I would almost hesitate if it didn't, or I would almost say if it didn't sound so self-serving, that it's better to come on in and check things out than to wait until they get worse. But I think a lot of people have benefited from that. Some signs that it's really a good time is if the communication situation has broken down to the point where you feel like you're not the influential parent anymore, that you feel like the whole world is controlling your kid and you have no say, that's probably a good time. If your kid is having a lot of trouble in school, particularly in 7th and 8th grade, this is where we see problems like attention deficit disorder really start to come to fruition. Better to get an evaluation and figure it out than to wait and see if he makes it through the semester or not. I think almost all kids who talk well benefit from some discussion of how they are forming relationships. And so if you see sons or daughters forming what you think are unhealthy relationships, dating particularly relationships, sometimes it's important to be able to talk with them about that yourself. But if that's difficult, or you don't quite get the lingo, or they don't want to talk, a good therapist will really be beneficial for you in that, because that will allow the kid to have a responsible adult who they also can relate to a little more openly. So all of those things, I think, pop up, as well as if you begin to see, obvious depression, or you get to some kids, you'll see some bipolar tendencies late in adolescence. I would always go sooner than later in trying to address those kind of needs.
So often we hear it's normal for adolescence to be a tumultuous, difficult time. Is that true?
Well, I think it has to be. I almost would go as far as to say if it's not, something isn't working right. And I actually think the variance there is not in the tumult, it's in the tolerance of the parent. If there are some parents who are just really calm in the middle of a storm, and they're like, yeah, that's kind of how it is, I've had 6 of these so far, and I know how to handle it, that usually is what calms the tumult. If you're going to define yourself as your own person, there's a certain amount of piercing your nose and getting purple hair and sneaking out at night and, having a minor car accident that just comes with the territory. And parents have to, in my view, express what I call external expectations of what their child is going to be doing in terms of that discipline we talked about. But they also have to have internal expectations. And that's where they understand, I will probably be dealing with some problems. My child probably won't be where I think she is. This is how I'm going to handle it. But you think about that inside, hold the line on your external expectations and then be ready to deal with the shortcomings that your child will undoubtedly have. And if you do all that, then the tumult will be in the kid mm-hmm. more than it is in your relationship with them.
What about that parent that encounters that child that is really rebellious, more so than the average teen?
Yeah, we see, of course, a lot of that because often the folks have waited a little longer than they probably should have, and so we're seeing people really at their zenith.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to really study what I call the person-environment interaction in that situation. Because sometimes that's a case where a young person is expressing a serious pathology like bipolar disorder and they can't control some of their outbursts. And you can see a lesser version of that with ADHD. But also, there may be problems in the home where the parents fight a lot. We see this, and the child is so tired of that that they are acting out angrily. Or you may see substance abuse in the home that the child is upset about, or even an abusive mm-hmm. home. And so you've got to look at both the person and the environment. And this is where having some years of experience really pays off. You need to have seen a few hundred of these before you start to be kind of that expert that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in Blink, where you just kind of look at it and you go, we're here.
Here we go.
Something's not right. And you know how that is. And so you really want to not jump to any conclusions. One of the biggest conclusions people jump to is, we got divorced, and that's why they're having all these problems. I see a whole bunch of kids from intact families that have the very same problems. So you have to figure out, is mm-hmm. this about the person, the system, or an interaction effect, and pick out the parts to intervene in.
What does depression look like?
Well, depression is interesting with teenagers because it takes so many forms and has so many different symptoms for teenagers, from anger to sullenness to lack of energy to too much energy to staying up all night, that it's hard to necessarily know that's what it is. This has become kind of the default diagnosis. If you mm-hmm. go to your physician and you say, my kid is doing X, Y, and Z, you're going to walk out of there with Prozac. That's usually not a complicated enough answer. And for example, if a person has ADHD, I always say, and sort of a wry manner, if you have ADHD and you're not depressed, you probably don't understand your situation very well. It's kind of depressing to have ADD, and mm-hmm. so that may be secondary to that particular problem. It's kind of depressing to be anxious all the time. Mm-hmm. So I see people, young people, who have a primary depression, but so often it's related to another disorder, or it's related to a bad breakup, or parents having a bad breakup, or another death or something. It's often loss-related. And so we just really have to explore that person-environment relationship again to figure out, what is this depression about? It can be so many different things.
How do you feel about medication?
I take it as much as possible. I have type 2 diabetes, so I'm a close friend of medication. But I know what I think medicine shouldn't be quite as controversial as it is. And I'll tell you what I think should be controversial is diagnosis. I absolutely don't believe there are too many people diagnosed, for example, with ADHD. I mm-hmm. absolutely know that is not correct. I know a bunch of people who are not properly diagnosed. The real issue is, are too many people misdiagnosed? And I think they are. And so, therefore, they're probably on medicines that may or may not be helpful for them. So good diagnosis is crucial, and that really requires some testing, not in a huge expensive testing. Around here, we can get that done for a couple hundred dollars, and it really shouldn't cost much more than that. But good testing that you can look at and compare to the norm group to see, is the child or the adolescent or the adult different from everyone their age? And if you do that, then you're going to get a better diagnosis. And medicine, there are those who believe there's a controversy about this, but mm-hmm. medicine, according to every national academy, psychiatry, pediatric psychology, is important in the treatment of ADHD, along with psychotherapy, to learn some organizational skills and how to manage your relationships. Depression is a little more interesting because, again, if you're depressed for a reason, medicating you for depression isn't going to probably resolve that. So we certainly do that in our clinic, but we have a very tight relationship with our clients so that we're really able to understand the impact that's having on them and whether it's helpful or not, as opposed to sending them out to Walgreens and hoping that things turn out better.
Right. The issues that tend to freeze most parents are drugs and sex. Do you have any suggestions regarding talking about drugs and sex for parents?
Yeah, I have probably enough to cover three more shows. These are such common issues, particularly sexuality. We have some very interesting and sometimes humorous columns in the book about this, and particularly the difficulty. I think I talk about sex so much that it's sort of like the mechanic changing a tire. It's not something that's very unusual. But I forget that a lot of parents, you know, really struggle with that, and so I try to help them make that a calm conversation. And the best way to do it is start when the child is much younger. And obviously you don't have the same conversation with a 7-year-old that you have with a 14-year-old, but that's when you start the conversation. And I always say one of the really touching best moments of my life was when my 16-year-old goddaughter and her boyfriend came up to visit for Christmas. And we went out for barbecue because, you know, that's what we do in Kansas. We go out for barbecue. And we were sitting around the table, and Chelsea looked over, and she said, "Let's talk about birth control." And that wasn't a shocker to me, but I looked over at the poor boy, and I thought he was going to, you know, throw up his barbecue at that point. And I said, "Well, is it okay with you if we discuss this?" And he nodded, kind of scared. And so we had a nice talk. And the best part of that conversation was Chelsea could finish every sentence that I started. Mm. Why is that? Because she and I had been talking about this in a calm, you know, non-scary way since she was, you know, 5 or 6 years old, in some version of that that's age appropriate. So that's the level of comfort parents want to have in this. If you can talk about who's going to go to the Super Bowl or be in the Final Four, you can talk about sex. Just get in front of the mirror and talk to yourself about it for a couple minutes every day, and you'll be okay. Drugs is oddly a little more controversial. I have a little more controversial view of this. I'm not really a big fan of marijuana, and my that's the one that kids are using pretty heavily at this point. And my teenagers I see just think I am from some kind of ancient world where people don't know what they're talking about. Marijuana has moved away from being recreational and experimental to really being kind of a way of life. And we see this in the media. Teenagers very much are pursuing that, and we've done a terrible job as a country of creating a kind of propaganda environment that teens don't trust about marijuana. They don't believe anything we say about it anymore, so they create their own propaganda. And they think in that propaganda that it's neater than anything to be a little stoned every day. So obviously, not everyone's doing it, but just about everybody has friends who are doing it quite a bit. And I think it's fine if parents want to stomp that out. If kids want to do that when they're 18, parents can't really control that. But parents have a lot of power to shut that down. And a lot of them don't want to put forth that level of scary effort.
You know, what we're talking about is communication. Having an open communication. Are there any hints to enhancing this? How parents can enhance communication. So often I don't think they know what communication means, at least from my experience, that it doesn't mean just spurring out words, that it also means listening. So would you talk to us a little bit about open communication?
Yeah, absolutely, and you're right on the money, that it's easy to talk at people, but people don't want to follow you. They don't want to be your disciple when you preach. They want to feel like they are, that you have their best interests at heart, and that you're also listening to their side of it. Now, some parents then don't understand that, and they think listening means you have to do what the kid says. That isn't the case. It's understanding and having what you and I talk about a lot, I'm sure, is empathy, having empathy for how the world is for the child. And only then can you really give good advice, whether they like it or not. At least they'll understand that you understand where they're coming from. So that's a big part of communication, and having it be reciprocal. And lectures are not usually the way to do that. Usually it's a dialogue.
Exactly. A couple things I want to talk about before we close, and that is sleep, exercise, and diet. So will you address those? Kids today don't get enough of any of those.
Yeah, and we could do a whole other discussion of why, which has to do with media, the mm-hmm. amounts of media consumption. But there's no way to prove it, but I think clinically we would all agree that what you said is true, that kids are not out exercising as much, and their eating habits are not good because so many of us are so busy. Parents are having to work harder and harder to make a living that it's awful easy to run by Sonic mm-hmm. on the way home or the drive-through or whatever. And so kids are not getting diets that are healthful. And we certainly know that mental health is affected by all of those things. And at the pinnacle of my list of frustrations is sleep. Kids are chronically sleep deprived, and again, partly because they are so locked in. Parents need to, my best tip for sleep is when parents hand their 7-year-old or whatever a cell phone, they do not hand them the charger. That goes in the parent's bedroom until the kid goes to college, and therefore kids cannot operate those devices at night.
Same Dr. West, we are out of time. Will you come back?
Oh, my goodness.
Will you come back again? I mean, really, can I call you again and you participate? Because the information that you have shared is just invaluable.
Well, Liz, any show called 411 Teen will always have access to me.
So okay.
I would love to come back. Let's just get it set up.
Okay. Thanks so much. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Many thanks to our panelists for the stimulating discussion. Audio copies of 411 Teen are available, and if you would like to participate in the program or suggest discussion topics, call toll-free 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. To subscribe to the 411 Teen podcast, log on to WFSU.org.